if one was to wake up from a substantial sleep and one were to take a break, could you combine the literacy line from the sleep with the literacy line for the bus?
Yes, you can. Yes. Now, there is a question about bathroom, but that's why there would be the same machlokas. Let's say I go to the bathroom. So I have to wash my hands to say Asher Yatzar, and then I have to wash my hands for bread. Now, there you have a big machlokas. There, many opinions say, and this is how we pass it, that it's better to wash your hands, say Asher Yatzar, and then wash for bread. But the problem there is, because since you have to recite a bracha, if you were to wash for bread, so Mimonetzach, you'd have a problem, because if I said Asher Yatzar, I might be mopsik between Akila Shadarim and Hamotzi. And if I defer Asher Yatzar till after Hamotzi, that's too much of a hepsik. So that is a problem only if it's a washing that you have to make a bracha for. Now, since when you get up from the sleep, you don't have to make any Amutila Shadayan, so it would be permissible to do kill two birds with one stone. You see, in other words, I would not compare it to the Asher Yatzar problem. So it'd be okay. Yeah.
Why don't we use that for food bucket made of milk?
Well, you know, that's not a bad suggestion, actually. There actually is a good reason to do that, because obviously there's milky particles, and then you're mixing them with meaty particles. The only thing is, let's identify what the problem is. In other words, let's assume that I get my toothbrush to have meat and milk together, you know, in it. But presumably, I'm going to eventually at some point rinse out my mouth. In other words, I'm not going to leave the dirty stuff in my teeth. And generally speaking, we don't assume that live teeth can become treif, so to speak. That's why you can have, you know, I can have meat and milk, you know, or milk and then meat, and we don't say even if it's hot, it doesn't become treif. So the point is, if you're asking me the question, is my toothbrush rendered treif? The answer is yes, it is. But if you're asking, is there any problem in using it? The answer is no, because generally speaking, as long as your mouth is clean, there's no tarpus in your mouth. So what you're saying is true, but it wouldn't raise a halachic issue. You see?
What do you mean by live teeth?
Huh? Well, by live teeth, I mean the teeth that God put into your mouth. In other words, dentures may be a problem. In other words, dentures can become treif, and removable dentures have to be kashered. In other words, let's assume I have dentures, and I want to use my dentures for Pesach. I have to take out my dentures and put them in boiling water to kosher them from the chametz. Now, I don't have to pull out my teeth. You know, good enough, and do that.
You can't be in life
or non-life. No, I mean teeth, I didn't mean that, but I meant basically, you know, implants would be the same thing. Implants would not have to be kashered either, but dentures, removable dentures do have to be kashered.
I was wondering if you'd please tell us a little bit about the history of different nusachs for prayers.
Yeah. This is a very interesting shaila. You know, all of us are familiar with the idea that there are different nusachos of prayer. We have Ashkenaz, Sfard are the most common. There's Eidut HaMizrach, which is different than Sfard. In fact, let me just tell you a little bit of an observation. What we call Nusach Sfarad is actually nothing more than the Hasidic version of Nusach Ashkenaz. And the reason it's called Nusach Sfarad is because when the Hasidic movement began, the Hasidim wanted to incorporate many of the Kabbalistic teachings of the Arizal, who davened Nusach Sfarad. So Nusach Sfarad, like you go to a Hasid, go to Dushinsky, or go to a Hasidic place, or even Kamarna, here, Nusach Sfarad is really just a Hasidic Ashkenaz, even though we call it Nusach Sfarad. Now, real Nusach Sfarad is what's called Eidut HaMizrach, and those are the tefillot. Of course, there are variations on that. Those are the tefillot of Moroccan, Syrian, Iraqi, and there are many, many different versions. Ravati Yosef wants to have a standardized version, but he hasn't been able to convince everybody. Moroccans still have their thing, and Tunisians have their thing. And even the Nusach Ashkenaz has different versions. There is the German Ashkenaz, and the Polish Ashkenaz, and the Hungarian Ashkenaz. And there's even the American Ashkenaz, which is a bit of a homogenization, and the like. And then, of course, you have things that are the odd man out, the Teimanim, which, although we like to call it just another Nusach Sfarad, but it's very, very different, and Teimanim don't like to be called Sfardi or whatever it is. And then there are some old Nuschaot that are largely extinct. There's the famous Italian Nusach of Rome. The Roman Nusach was a very famous Nusach. I believe there's only like one shul in Yerushalayim that still has the old Roman Nusach. It's very distinct. Is that one there? Yeah. And then there's some old French Nuschos, which were very, very interesting, which are, I think, totally extinct. But, you know, maybe one place in Switzerland and the like. Now, the thing to know about Nuschos, though, it's very important to know that Nuschos are 85 to 90% the same no matter what. That's the important thing. You can walk into a Yemenite synagogue, and if you know the sitter, you know, you'll live, you'll survive. Sometimes people panic. People go to me, and maybe if you're not so familiar, I'm going to, you know, Sephardic synagogue, what do I do, you know, you know, and again, we have halachas of what you say, and so there are different minhagim of shlichos, but the truth of the matter is, 90% is very familiar, Psukei de Zimra with somewhat of a different order, yes, Birchos Kriya Shema, a few different words here. Shimona Esrei. Tachanun is a little bit of a different positioning. But, you know, structurally, we're dealing with a 90% familiarity issue, which is very good, because the Nusach and the structure and even the wording of Tefillah is 90% the same no matter where you go. And that's a very important thing to know. One shouldn't over-exaggerate the Shinuyim that we have in all of these Nuschos. Now, the question is, what is the origin? Because here's our problem. According to the Gemara, the Nusach, the text of our Tfilos, was enacted by a very specific body, and that body is called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the people of the Great Assembly. This included Ezra and Nehemiah and Mordechai of Purim Fei, and this was a particular time, the beginning of the Bayit Sheni. So that would seem to indicate they did one thing. So that would mean, if by definition it changes, either somebody got it wrong or everybody got it wrong. I mean, meaning, if you assume a unitary origin for things, then if there are changes, then somebody is deviating from the unitary origin. Now, that's less of a problem. Let me point out, that's less of a problem with things like slichos. Slichos is one of the very noticeable differences between Ashkenazim and Sfardim, because Ashkenazim, we only say slichos a few days before Rosh Hashanah, and we have different slichos every day, and Sfardim start Rosh Chodesh Elul, right? That's one of the disadvantages of Sfardim. So when you decide, I want to be Ashkenazi or Sfardim, you got away right on Pesach versus getting up, here we do it at Mincha time, but you know, if you're really doing it right, 5 o'clock in the morning, Rosh Chodesh Elul. But Slichos is less of a problem, because Slichos is not from the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Slichos is a much later origin. It is from the time of the Gaonim, after the Gemara. And in any way, Shayach, different communities of Chatzila had different customs. So that's not a problem. But when we're dealing with Shimona Esrei, what's the text of Knesset? Even if there are minor differences, one might say, hey, what did the Anshei Knesset HaGdola do? So we have basically two approaches here. Approach number one basically says that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, this is what the Torah writes. The Torah writes that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola did not establish a word-for-word Shimona Esrei or anything. They established a structure and an order of brachos, and they established how each bracha should end. You know, bracha to Hashem, this and that, rofei choleh, and then they left it l'chatchila to each community to, you know, within the structure they were given, to, you know, develop their own words, their own vocabularies, etc. So consequently, when you have different nuschos, they represent, again, it wasn't originally so much Ashkenaz and Sfarad. It really was more decentralized than that. It was this city, and that city, and that city, and that city, and that city. But eventually, there tended to be what you might call a geographically based homogenization, where all the cities in a certain area, you know, would eventually standardize their nusach. But before that, at some point, it was even more decentralized. Every city had a different, chazan had a different thing. So that's that is possibility number one, that there is no official word for word tefillah of Anshei Knesset HaGdola. They gave us the structure and the order and the outline, and they left it to local kehilos to develop the tefillah that was most meaningful to them, and that's the basis. And that which survived represented some of the nuschos that were there, and there were many more that maybe didn't survive, as I indicated. Al-Pi Kabbalah, the Arizal, offers a different mahalach. The Arizal says, Kabbalistically, and there's some problems with this, that just the Mishnah says in Maseches Midos, which is not Pirkei Avos. Midos is the dimensions of the Beis Hamikdash. It's not referring to character. In Maseches Midos, it mentions that there were 13 gates to the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash. 13 gates. And the purpose of the 13 gates was each shevet, each tribe, as it had its own unique gate to enter the Beis Hamikdash. And if you did not know your shevet, you entered through a general shar that's called Shar HaKolel. And the idea is, the spiritual idea behind that is, each shevet has a unique relationship with God as an individual tribal unit. So that's why there are camps, that's why there are flags, different missions, Yisachar, Zevulun, etc. So the Arizal wants to posit that there are 13 basic nuschei satzfila, because each shevet had its own nusach, which was more or less the same, but there are some differences that kabbalistically reflect the neshama of that particular shevet. And those which survive are remnants of tribal nuschais. Now, the problem with that is, of course, let's say we're all davening Ashkenaz in this room, let's say. Well, if Ashkenaz represents a particular tribe, well, who says we're all from the same tribe, right? That is why the Ari argued that Nusach Ari was the 13th gate. That's why the Arizal made the claim that he had formulated Al-Pi Kabbalah, that Nusach Ari was exactly the right Nusach for a person who did not know his Shevet and the like. Now, the question is, of course, what is Nusach Ari? That's a very, very difficult issue. Nusach Ari literally should mean the Nusach that the Arizal davened in, which had Kabbalistic Kabbanis. Now, those of you who know that the common term Nusach Ari is commonly employed for the Nusach of a Chabad Siddur. But let me explain why that's so. There were many, many versions of Nusach Ari. In fact, every Hasidish Nusach is a variant of Nusach Ari. That's why Hasidim developed this variation of Nusach Ashkenaz to encompass the Arizal. And if you ever look in a Sfard, any Sephardic Siddur, I don't mean Eidot HaMizrach, any Ashkenazic Sephardic Siddur, you will see a lot of things in parentheses, many, many more parentheses, because there are so many uncertainties. What is the right Nusach, etc.? So the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, claims that he went through 50 different versions of Nusach Ari to arrive at what, in his judgment, was the authentic Nusach Ari. Now, whether that's true or not is not for us to judge, but that's the Chabad's claim, or the Alter Rebbe's claim, the Baal HaTanya's claim, that his Siddur represents the Nusach Ari, but other people who daven Nusach Sfarad disagree with that. They say that doesn't represent Nusach Ari. So those are the two basic ideas of the origins of Nusach. One is the Chatchila, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola left it to every community. The other is that the Chatchila, they were misaking 13 variations based on different Shvatim, and what has survived are remnants of that. By the way, I once heard, I'm trying to trace this down because I cannot find it inside, I may have said this here before, that some want to suggest this Kabbalistic explanation, some want to suggest for a much more difficult problem, and that is, now you raised the mystical Tefillah, and that I could answer as I answered that, you know, the Chatchila, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola gave rishus for different variations. But some raised the question about differences in Sifrei Torah. Now, we do like to point out that of all of the tens of thousands of Sifrei Torah that exist in the world, they are exactly the same 99.999%, which is very true. On the other hand, that means there is a difference of 0.0001%, meaning there are some minor differences in Sifrei Torah, how words are spelled and the like. And the question becomes, if the Torah comes from God, and God gave this inviolate text, how is it possible for there to be a break in the tradition? If we assume a break in the tradition, then we're in trouble with all sorts of things, the oral law and, you know, everything else. So one of the answers that was given is that Moshe Rabbeinu himself wrote 12 different Sifrei Torah for the different tribes. And it might be, through reasons we don't fathom, that Al-Pi Hashem, these minor differences were put in because different Shvatim needed a tiny, tiny little different type of message that we don't even understand the significance of that. So that would be a test for that as well, although, as I say, I have not been able to find a clear makor Mokrid, etc. Okay, so that's kind of the origin of Nusach HaTzvila. Bottom line is, at least with the Evet, you are Yotzei no matter what Nusach HaTzvila you daven. So if you're stuck, and you know you can only daven what you're familiar with, you do that. If you daven that which you're not familiar with, you're also Yotzei. Now, if you're davening in a shul with a different Nusach, so the procedure that you follow is, with respect to your private davening, you daven your Nusach. With respect to anything you're doing with the congregation, like Kedusha, or the answering of Kaddish, you follow the Nusach of the shul that you are in. Right? So you actually do continue to take your Ashkenaz Siddur in a Sephardic shul, and you know, daven your Ashkenaz Siddur.
How is the development of Nusach Sephardic not like a measure of tradition? It seems like it was pretty clear that's a late creation.
Are you talking about the Hasidic version?
Yeah.
Well, that's 100% correct. That's why the Vilna Gaon, for example, one of the Vilna Gaon's criticisms of the Hasidic movements, a very strong criticism, was they were mishaneh, they deviated from the traditional text of tefillah in their geographical areas. Well, that's 100% correct. Essentially, thank you. Essentially, this involved a group of people who were Ashkenazim who decided to adopt certain practices of Sephardim. That's exactly what it is. And in that sense, there was a lot of criticism, but, you know, again, it's hard to see. Now, once it's been done, it's now a minute of several hundred years. So, in effect, it now becomes an official sanctioned minute. But its original justification was very, very difficult. However, I want to point out, in defense of, you know, just to show that Ashkenazim themselves are not free of blame, Chacham Ravadja says, that's the same problem with Ashkenazim who came to Eretz Yisrael. When Ashkenazim came in larger numbers to Eretz Yisrael in the middle of the 1800s, the majority population of Jews that were here were Sephardim, Eidut HaMizrach. Rav Avadya says they had no right to daven Ashkenaz here. They came to a Sephardic community. They are mechuyav to daven Nusach Sfarad. So Rav Avadya actually says that the importation of Nusach Ashkenaz into Eretz Yisrael was totally illegitimate. So maybe that's kind of the Ashkenaz revenge. You know, the Hasidim took Nusach Sfarad and brought it into Ashkenaz. The Ashkenazim took Nusach Ashkenaz, they brought it into Eretz Yisrael. But to this day, he basically says Ashkenazim shouldn't, he's going to tolerate them not because they've been doing it for hundreds of years, but he says, you know, the Iker HaDin, Ashkenazim were mechuyev to be Sephardic in Eretz Yisrael, in all of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually have two questions, because one of them is from a friend outside, the Yeshiva, and one of them is a personal question. The question is, the first one, if a child is born, right, and from two parents, the man was Jewish, and the woman, she was Jewish, but I guess either the seed or the egg came from like a bank that, like the you know, that was registered Jewish, like the seed itself or the egg itself was Jewish.
Yeah.
The child born is it Jewish?
Okay, so this is this is already by this time it's already a well-known shaila because it happens a lot. Infertility treatments. You can, if a woman, let's say a woman doesn't ovulate, she doesn't produce an egg, so it's possible to have an egg from a non-Jewish donor that a Jewish woman carries, or vice versa, it's possible, which is your case, it's possible to have a Jewish egg that is fertilized by Jewish sperm that is carried by a non-Jewish woman, and the term that goes by surrogate mother, or whatever, and the halachic question is a very, very severe question, and that is, Jewish status is based on the mother, everybody knows that. Seder, based on the mother, not based on the father. Question is, when who is the mother in this type of case? Do I look at the egg, which is the source of the genetic information that is passed from the mother? Or do I look at gestation, the one that carried the baby for nine months? The bottom line halacha, according to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, is that we have a suffek to oraisa, a suffek. Whether I follow gestation, the birth mother, or I follow the egg donor mother, and as a result, the child is a suffek goy, suffek Jew. Mi suffek, the child needs to have a conversion. Now, a majority of poskim say a little differently. A majority of poskim say that we just follow the birth mother, not the egg donor, and that means If the mother who delivered the baby is Jewish, baby is Jewish even if the egg is non-Jewish. And vice versa, however, if the egg is Jewish and the mother is not Jewish, the baby, or the birth mother is not Jewish, the baby vadai needs a conversion. Right? So that's a machlokas. So in your particular question, either way the baby needs conversion, the machlokas would be, is it a conversion which is a vadai conversion, or a conversion that is a suffix conversion. Now let me just point out that some want to bring a very interesting raya to this shaila from a medrash, which is pretty unusual. We very rarely prove halachos from a medrash, and that is the story. If you remember, Targum Yonis ben Uzziel says that when Leah was pregnant with her 11th child, which was Dina, she was actually carrying a boy. Right? Leah was pregnant with number 11, and Rachel was pregnant. So according to Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel, Rachel was carrying a girl, who would have been Dina, and Leah was carrying a boy, who would have been Yosef. But Leah prayed to Hashem, because she didn't want, because there's only 12 tribes, so if Leah has 11 tribes, that only leaves one son, Binyamin, for Rachel, and that would make her inferior to the maidservants. So Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel says, Leah prayed, and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did was, miraculously, he switched the embryos. This is Targum Yonasan. It's a little different than Rashi. In other words, Hashem took the male embryo, miraculously, out of Leah's body and put it into Rachel's body. And Hashem took the female embryo out of Rachel's body and put it into Leah's body. This is Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel. So now it turns out, actually, that each one was a surrogate for the genetic egg of the other. Because it now turns out, according to Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel, that Dina is genetically the daughter of Rachel, and Yosef is genetically the son of Leah, and yet throughout the Torah, Yosef is called Rachel's child, and Dina is called Leah's child. So from here we have a raya, that birth mother, the one who gives birth, is called the mother. You see, that's the raya from the Medrash, and that would be a raya to that second view. If Shlomo Zalman says he doesn't want to bring a raya from the Medrash that way, and therefore he says it's a something. So that would be, yeah, you had one more question?
Yeah, yeah. I remember this practice called like sun gazing, and it's not a religious practice, but it's basically it's sort of like a health practice where it has some kind of like spiritual or supernatural kind of things to it, but not everybody, you know, like talks about it. Mostly it's a health practice where somebody actually like takes off their shoes, they stand on the ground and they look at the sun for 9 months and like 10 seconds. Have it on every single day.
But you have to take off your shoes?
Yeah, you have to take off your shoes because there's like a kind of like a spiritual connection to the ground and to like the sun, which like you could actually eventually maybe not even eat food or something like that. And I saw it online. I wanted to know if, and that's not the best place, but I wanted to know, I just wanted to know if it's like, if it's something that would be against the law or something to be considered.
I would be suspicious. Now, being out in the sun is certainly healthy. It produces vitamin D. And that's why people who are inside all the time could have a vitamin deficiency. Looking at the sun, we were told as little kids, I remember, you know, it could be potentially dangerous for your eyesight. But now, if they would be touting something just for its health benefits, you know, go ahead and do it. You know, you can do yoga if you disassociate it from the idolatry and the like. But when you have various practices that are connected to spiritual forces, I think, you know, you're entering a red line zone, or at least a cautionary area, because some of these forces might be connected to Tuma, they might be connected to Avodah Zarah, they might be connected to paganism. So I would have to look into it a bit more. Maybe I'll see what I can find. But I think the initial reaction is don't get involved in it, because you never know where these things lead. And that's really the whole problem generally, although this is not the same thing. There's a whole field of medicine that is very, very popular today. It started off with acupuncture, which is just the manipulation of needles. But now there's many, many fields of medicine that are called energy healing. And if energy healing is healing by touch, not even by touch, healing by, you know, forces, manipulating spiritual forces. And these treatments are very effective. They actually work in many, many cases. But, you know, they work by manipulating various spiritual aspects of a person's personality. And certainly Kabbalistically, we recognize that some of those manipulations can come from holiness, and some of them can come from impurity. And externally, you might not be able to tell the difference, but, you know, the neshama gets affected. So you're dealing with some very, very powerful things here. In fact, the other way, I'm not dismissing it as being quackery. I'm acknowledging the possibility that it might be a very real thing, but without knowing the sources of it, you don't want to fool around with things that get into your neshama. That's why people ask me, when we go to energy healing, and there are, Baruch Hashem, religious, learned people who are now involved in this, that you can actually go to. But somebody asked me, can I go to an energy healer who's not religious? Now, I thought to myself, I think there's a big difference between going to a dentist who's not religious and going to an energy healer who's not religious. When you have a dentist, when somebody is just working on the goof, so whatever, they're relating to you on the body, goshmi level, all right, so even if they're not from, they could be a good doctor. But when you're going to somebody who's fooling around with your neshama, you got to be careful. You want someone that is doing so with kedusha. Yeah.
Does the vacuum have to fall into the red line category that you just described?
Well, I think not. Well, how they manipulate what? They're like chiropractors? What do they do with that?
You know, someone will come in with a sore back or tight muscles, and they're trying to align it, and the osteopath will sit there, like, moving the temples around for 20 minutes and then fix it.
I think it's something to think. It's something to think about. You know, again, you have to delve into it, and you have to discuss it both with a doctor and maybe with a rabbi that's familiar with it. But I think the whole realm of non-physical manipulations to produce health do raise some serious issues. That even something which isn't so spooky, even something like psychotherapy. You know, when you're dealing with psychological therapies. Two, it's better. I'm not saying it's indispensable. Once you discuss this, but it's better to have somebody that is shomer mitzvos because they're dealing with your psyche, with your feelings, with your emotions. That's a very different type of thing than just the physical structure of your body. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you said before that these things could be connected to tumah, but I remember when this is one of the things that. Always brought up, you know, the men versus women, Judaism issue that like tumah is not a bad thing. It's just, you know, like we're all tumah nowadays. When you say that, do you think they have a connection to tumah? Like, what does it actually mean? What like, okay, I'm tumah's mate anyway, that means to a favor. So like. I'm trying to understand what...
I mean, ultimately, I'll tell you, I cannot fully explain it either. But powers of tumah are going beyond the technicalities of a tumah mace. Powers of tumah mean that in order to facilitate free will in the world, God gave, Kabbalistically, he says, God gave powers of evil, certain abilities to do things. And that's why there's Bechira, because I could choose to go with God's way. In other words, God, as it were, created... I shouldn't call it a rivalry because God obviously is above it, but God created at least the appearance of a rival that can do different types of things. And therefore, it's possible for a person to tap into these impure forces. I mean, that's the source of magic, right? Pyro. Pyro's magicians. Now, we believe. Now, maybe you don't have that today. Today, magicians are fake. You know, they'll say that. But we do believe there was such a thing as genuine magic, which the Torah doesn't allow you to do. Now, what is magic? Magic are these manipulations that come from powers of impurity, demonic forces, evil forces, and the like. So that's what I mean. I don't mean the narrow halachic definition of becoming tamei because you're in contact with the dead, but I mean tapping into the dark forces. Again, you know, if any of you ever read, forgive me, if any of you ever read any of the Harry Potter books, now I had a young son during that age, so I'm familiar with him on some level. It's the first one. Again, don't tell anybody. But but you know, it actually portrays a world somehow which actually corresponds to what we believe exists. In other words, there are dark forces. There are powers of evil. Now, God is above everything. And we turn only to Hashem. But Hashem enabled these forces because that facilitates Bechira in the world, the ability to choose good or evil. And consequently, that's why there's magic, or at least when there was magic. That is why you have sometimes Rishayim that are able to do things that look semi-miraculous. It's not that we deny it, but they're utilizing kochos of tumah. That is why false Kabbalah is very, very dangerous. Sometimes it's just meaningless because the people don't know anything, so it's just stupid. But other times, you know, there are people that can do things, but you know, you're kind of imprisoned under their influence in different ways. So anything that involves manipulating your mind, your neshama, one has to be very, very careful. That's all I'm saying. It's you're dealing with things that are real and potentially dangerous. Yeah.
Is there any yacht or story in Kabbalah or Torah or person that does something like sun gazing? I mean, it does Abraham sun gazing to be compared?
Well.
If you do the Shem Shammai for the yacht,
you know, it's very, very possible. You know, Aryeh Kaplan, Olav HaShalom, great, great man, died tragically very young. And I've always had a thesis, you know, he delved into Kabbalah very, very deeply. And we have warnings that the Kabbalah too much that could endanger you. But he wrote three books on Jewish meditation. One is called Jewish Meditation, one is called Meditation and the Bible. And the third is Meditation and Kabbalah. And these, you know, these works, if you're interested, are kosher works. And they're works you can look at. This is somebody who, you know, knew the Torah, knew the Kabbalah, and was able to integrate them into various meditative techniques. And he tries to say that a lot of these things, Avram looking at the stars and etc., did represent various states of meditation, which brought them into trances, which gave them prophecy. And the like. But once again, it's like anything else, you have to know how to invoke the powers of purity versus how to invoke the powers of impurity. And that's not a cheap thing. That's not simply you learn a trick somewhere. That depends on one's righteousness, one's midos, one's prayers, one's overall learning, etc. So if you can do this, it's only after a very, very long process where you're with a teacher and a rebbe and a tzaddik, etc. And a person without Yiras Shamayim, we absolutely believe, cannot be connected to the powers of Tahara, no matter how impressive they are, even if they can tell the future and they can tell you all sorts of things. And there were such people who could tell you, you know, they could look at you and tell you your life story. And we don't deny that as a possibility. See, we're not saying they're fake. But we're saying it comes from the Koach Atuma, which is a very, very dangerous thing. That's all. So you have to be careful. Yeah.
Yeah. Following on from the discussion about different nisachs.
Yeah.
Also complaining about the different yochagim as well. Why can't I just pick and choose from different ones? Why do I have to follow a specific?
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing. You know, there is a powerful idea in Yiddishkeit that you should follow the minhagim of either your community where you live now or your family if you have a tradition, and that's because we don't serve Hashem as isolated atoms floating in space. We serve Hashem as part of a community of people who come together, and therefore a person has to belong to a community. Now, it is true, I've mentioned it before, that if you're a Baal Tshuva who's new to Judaism, let's say, or new to Torah Judaism, so many poskim say you're not obligated to like do what your great-grandfather did. In other words, you can come, you know, you could even become Sephardic if you want. You know, you could, if, you know, you could say, okay. But you shouldn't pick and choose, so to speak. You know, I like Sephardic rice, but I like Ashkenazi. You know, in other words, you go, you know, you gotta belong to a community. Because our connection to Hashem is the fact that we're also linked in achdus and unity. Now, I have told people before that there are certain things in which you are allowed to pick and choose because they are considered to be somewhat fringe areas, although they're important. I've told people, for example, slichos. I have told people that you're allowed to do Sephardic slichos instead of Ashkenazic slichos because slichos is not absolutely mandatory, technically. It's an old practice, but you can do it this way and do it that way, you know, and either way is good. On the other hand, for a core Nusach HaTfilah, one should try to be, thank you, sorry to trouble you. one has to try to be consistent. You know, it goes back to the idea of Kehila. You want to be part of Beit Yehuda, and that's very important. Yeah.
If hypothetically, I mean, yeah.
Well, let me tell you this. There were individual Gedolim, and there are, I guess, in Israel, who sometimes do exactly that. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, for example. Great Gedol. He was a Rav Tutlis Fadlon. He was a great Gedol. He was Ashkenaz, of course. He came from Poland. But there were many cases where he paskined like the Rambam. He just said, I went through the sugya. So if you're a Gedol, you can do that. If you're a Gedol, like you say, I've gone through all the sugyas, and I think the Rambam is more correct than Tosfos. But I don't think, frankly, any of us are on that much area. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it's a Gedol, Rebbe Yosef, somebody who really went through all of the sugyas, could come to a decision, what he thought was the right one, and he would be permitted, at least privately, not publicly, privately, to kind of say, this is what I do. Because I was machria a sugya. I think it's extremely rare for most of us to reach that type of decision. I mean, for example, a poseg like Rebbe Yosef, I don't know if he ever did this per se, you know, could look at the Mishnah Berurah and say, okay, the Mishnah Berurah was wrong on this one. I could never do that. You know, I could never do that. I think none of us could ever do that, right? We might follow another psak in our Rebbe, whatever it is, but we're not going to say, I went through the sugya independently. And I think the Chafetz Chaim didn't get it right in this particular case. You know, it wouldn't be, you know, so we have to be realistic as to what our madrega is. The Vilna Gaon argued with Rishonim. Now people say, this is how we teach kids. We say, you know, we almost make it a rule, like who made up this rule? He says, Achronim are not allowed to argue with Rishonim except for the Vilna Gaon. This is the rule that we tell of, you know, fifth grade kids. Well, you know, who made up that rule? An Achron can argue the Mishnah except for the Vilna Gaon. And the answer is the Vilna Gaon made up that rule. Meaning to say, theoretically, it is shaykh for a person who, if they really, really knew, they could say, but this would require a gadol shebikdolim. And the gadol has to, you know, be aware of this. I'm saying this is not something that even the average gadol would be able to do. You know, in Kal v'chomer, people who are not gadolim. Yeah.
Two famous machlokes in history. One between the Vilna Gaon and the early Hasidim, and then later on, Rav Shach and the Babish. And please, I've heard so many.
Well, this is a sad machlokas in many ways. You know, Chabad is, actually, I've been in correspondence with somebody. He's still learning here. He wants to join a Lubavitcher yeshiva, so we were talking about the pros and the cons of that issue. Let me just say this, that, you know, Chabad has done many, many wonderful things in the world. I mean, there is no question in terms of the Chabad houses, in terms of the outreach, in terms of the Kira of Rechokin. Many people have been brought to some level of Judaism. Now you could argue they don't keep them in learning Gemara and this and that, which is certainly a taina. But L'chol Pachas people have become Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, and the like. And they do a lot of good things. They're very warm. They're very friendly. I know that if you're cynical, you say, well, so are Jews for Jesus. Okay, I understand that. But they do good things. Now, the problem that really has poisoned the well in all of this is really the Mashiach issue. Now, the Mashiach issue is really an outgrowth of something that's been going on even before the Mashiach controversy, and that is Chabad tends to be more and more separated from the general Masorah of Am Yisrael. It's a very simple example. If you go to a Chabad yeshiva, you will never hear a story about the Chafetz Chaim. You will never hear anything about the Or Sanhedrin. You'll never hear about anybody. All you will hear about is the Rebbe and, to some lesser degree, the six predecessor Chabad Rebbes. It's as if there is no Jewish people outside of Chabad. Now, that was Chisorin, but then it turned into much worse when it was the Rebbe's Mashiach and everything else. So Rav Shach thought that this was a very, very dangerous tendency, that the idea of a false Mashiach has been very destructive in Am Yisrael. because chaps like Tzvi and the like, and therefore he was very, very adamant that that not be allowed to spread. Now let me say, Chabad in Eretz Yisrael tended and tends to be much more extreme than Chabad in America. So Rav Shach was dealing with very, very extreme cases, and some of the Mashichas in Chabad shaded into something that's even worse, in which they were not just saying the Rebbe as Mashiach, but they were ascribing a divinity. They're saying the Rebbe, again, this is only a fringe, a crazy fringe, but they say the Rebbe represents the physical incarnation of divinity. Of course, that sounds awfully like a different religion, you know, which we Paskin is actually a Avodah Zarah for, etc. So this was a very, very dangerous thing. Now, Sir Rav Shach had, you know, wanted to... Well, okay. Don't take Chayram as serious as you might think. Chayram, let me give you an example. You know, I'm going to tell you a little story about, I think illustrates this. You know, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky once had to go on a diet. The doctor put him on a special diet. And he was on the diet for a few months. And then he came to the doctor and he complained that he was losing weight rapidly. He was emaciated. And the doctor said, "What's wrong? Why are you emaciated?" So he says, "I don't know. I've been following the diet exactly." He says, "Oh, that's the problem." He says, "I know that when I put people on a diet, they're going to eat double the amount of food they're supposed to eat. So when I give them a diet, I give them half the calories they're supposed to take. Because I know they'll double it and they'll be living with the diet. You kept the diet, no matter, of course you started." Let me just say that the way things work here is that if you put somebody in chayrim, like you go all the way, so the hope is going to be people will distance themselves appropriately. In other words, if they would just say, you know, don't get too connected to Chabad, people would say, okay, oh, then, you know, they'll get connected. So, okay, chayrim, so at least they'll keep a certain distance. Same thing with internet, you know. There's a chayrim against the internet. Ah, Yor Sameach has a website. Why do we have a website? Why does HR have a website? The answer would be that if the Lushan would be, well, the internet's dangerous, try to keep away, so the person would say, okay, keep away, all right, so I'll just do it 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day, you know, no big deal. Say chayrim, so I'll only do it a half an hour a day. You know? So, chayrim don't really mean a lot. It's like even the Dome of Dome's chayrim. Which with the chayrim, I mean, we don't keep it, right? Etc. Although I know some of us that claim that the Dome of Dome's chayrim is still binding. But I think the main issue was the Mashiach's issue and the issue of separating from the general Messiah of Am Yisrael. Now, having said that, though, Rav Shach was addressing dangerous tendencies within the movement. But there are certainly individual Chabad Shuluchim that are very, very fine, very, very good. And I wouldn't postulate them as individuals that at all. Right? So one has to, you know, just be a little bit careful. Yeah.
What is the reason behind Judaism having natural
label descent? Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, there's a Ramban in Chumash. The Ramban actually says, before Matan Torah in Mitzrayim, the definition of a Jew was passed down to the father. So when the Reform movement says, right, the Reform movement makes a claim that the original halacha was patrilineal descent and it was changed later, they are in a sense right. That is, before Sinai, it was patrilineal, and after Matan Torah, it was matrilineal, etc. Right? So now, why halacha said it that way is an interesting question. The simplest answer, which is the simplest answer, is that before there was DNA testing, you only knew a person's mother, you didn't know a person's father, right? So if a woman gives birth to a child, you can assume it's from the husband, but you don't know for sure. It could have been mezano with somebody. So as a result, you could not base status on father because you don't know who the father is. On the other hand, I find that reason a little difficult. Because after all, we do base tribal affiliation on the father, even though you have the identical problem. The other idea is, again, based on the more mystical idea. The Gemara says that before a child is born, the angel studies Torah with that child in the womb. And the angel fills the child's neshama with Torah and Kedusha and ruchnius and a connection to God. And even though the angel then hits the child on the lip and the child forgets, but the spiritual impression on the neshama is still there. Now, if we take that chazal seriously, what that is saying is that the 9 months of pregnancy, in fact, that would go back to the idea of the surrogate, that if it's in a non-Jewish woman, that's why post can say the child is a goy, right? Then we say that Jewish identity is essentially created through that 9 month gestational experience. So consequently, if the mother is a goy who did not convert, the child didn't have that input, as it were. And therefore, the neshama does not achieve its Jewish status. So that might be part of the reason. Yeah.
How far are we allowed to, I guess, bend the truth in haggling for a better price? In other words, saying, like, we don't have any more cash than we do, or something like that.
Yeah, this raises the interesting philosophical question, which is a question both in halacha and in moral philosophy. And that is a lie a lie if nobody believes it anyway? Meaning to say the following. Generally speaking, you're not allowed to cheat, you're not allowed to misrepresent, you're not allowed to say things that are not factually true, and in the context of business transactions, that is what is called geneva stas. Right? Geneva stas is deception. Let me emphasize as well that the Gemara is absolutely clear that the issue of geneva stas applies not only to a Jewish, towards a Jew, it even applies towards a non-Jew. Okay, one has to be very, very careful. You don't make any false claims. Now, the question becomes this. The question becomes, and I'm not going to definitively poskin here, the question becomes that when there is a ritualistic game that is played, and everybody knows it's a game. For example, in the old Arab markets, I don't know if they do it today, but in the olden days when things were a bit more peaceful, you go with the Arab shuk and you would bargain, and by definition, you would always offer a price that was much lower than you were willing to pay, and then you would say, that's all I'm going to pay, and whatever, there'd be a game. And it was expected. And in fact, when you agreed to the Arab price, you would actually say, no, we're supposed to bargain here. You're not following the script. Now, so in that type of stylized ritual, it's like a play act, and then you can say what you want to say. But the emphasis is, if you're really going to convey the impression to that other person that you don't have any money, it's not proper to say those things. So you have to be careful. That's interesting. We read in last week's Parsha, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa of Yibam. I would like another one. I'm sorry to trouble you. I need to get a whole picture here. Thank you. I apologize. Yes, go. Thank you. But I'm getting you your exercise for today. Now the thing is that the Torah says it's a mitzvah d'oraisa of Yibam, and only if you don't want to do it is there a ceremony called chalitza. Now it's very clear in the Torah that Yibam is the preferred thing to do, and chalitza is the second choice, and that is actually why the woman spits at the guy. Because you say, you're a despicable person, you don't want to build your brother's home. Now today, the funny thing is, that even if a man and a woman, the man is single, the woman is single, of course the woman is a widow, he wants to do Yibam, she wants Yibam, we say, sorry, can't do it. Now the emphasis is, this is really a machlokas among Ashkenazi, it's machlokas in the Gemara ultimately, but it's a machlokas among Ashkenazi and Sephardic Poskim. Sephardim, actually Matar Yibam. The custom is they don't do it today because no one, the Ashkenazim don't do it, but I believe that the last Yibum that we have, she died very recently, I think a woman had Yibum in 1920, and it's very, very interesting because she was married for many years to her first husband. There were no children. Everybody assumed she was infertile. And then she got married, there was Yibum. And Baruch Hashem, she had 10 children from the second marriage. And she talks about, she just died a few years ago, and she was telling her grandson how she loved both of her husbands, and it was a good relationship, and the like. So I think that's kind of the last Yibama, who just died a few years ago. But Ashkenazim don't do Yibam, and it's based on a statement of Abba Shaul in the Gemara. Abba Shaul says the following. Yibam is a very strange thing. Because on one hand, it's a mitzvah. On the other hand, marrying your brother's wife, even if she's a widow, is one of the arayos. It is a forbidden erva. So when it's not a mitzvah, it's actually a sin. It's never neutral. Like I'll tell you a story about Rav Chaim Oizer in a moment. So consequently, Avishol develops the idea that if something is inherently sinful, but it becomes a mitzvah, it loses its sinful character only if your kavana is 100% l'shem shamayim, that you're marrying her only for the purpose of doing the mitzvah of Yibam, and not because of your own sexual desires or gratification. And therefore, as a result of Abba Shaul's ruling in the Gemara Yevamos, the Ramah paskins that bizman hazeh, we are not batuach that our kavana is l'shem shamayim, and therefore we treat every Yibam as a potential giloy arayos, and that is why our minhag is not to do Yibam. Sfardim, I guess, are more confident in l'shem shamayim, where they don't pass on like Abba Shaul, because Abba Shaul is making a certain cheshbon that it's forbidden unless your kavana is l'shem mitzvah. The Rambam says, no, there's a mitzvah of Yibam, so good. If it's permitted, it's permitted. Now, let me just tell you a neat story about Rav Chaim Mirza Grodzinski. Rav Chaim Mirza Grodzinski was Gadol Hador in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, great, brilliant posek, but a person who also was a Baal Chesed, unbelievable Baal Chesed, and a person who really was responsible for all of the yeshivas coming to Vilna during the war. I mean, he saved tens of thousands of people by getting them to Vilna and getting them support and the like. He died in 1940, at the very beginning of the Holocaust, or towards the beginning of the Holocaust. Now, the story goes that he was sickly, and he often had to leave Vilna, particularly in the summer, but he would try to get back to Vilna for Slichos and Yamim Naran. But one time he was stranded in some German resort, German-Austrian health resort, and it was Slichos. And although there was a minion of, you know, simple Jews who lived there, but, you know, he was not... There were no Talmidei Chachamim and the like. And he was very, very upset. He was sad that he was such a God-forsaken place, you know, an abandoned place without learning, without Talmidei Chachamim, without Sfarim. And he's just wandering around. And he bumps into a Yid who seems to be a Yid from Poland, Lithuania. So he's very happy to at least see a Lansman. He says, Rav Yid, it's good to see you. He says, what brings you here? So the Jew says, well, I live in Poland, you know. But my brother lived here. My brother was a businessman. And my brother died, leaving a widow with five young children. And I thought to myself that, you know, it's not right for a widow to have five young children and be all by herself. So I came here to marry her. Now, keep in mind that not only is there no mitzvah of Yibam, but if the brother's widow has children, it's an erva. It is an iser d'oraisa. It's a chiyuv kares. So Chaim Moser, you know, is astounded. He says, Reb Yid, you're not allowed to marry her. He says, so the man says, you know, I don't listen to every rabbi who comes and says, you know, all you guys have chumras and this and that. He says, I want to keep the Beit HaGalacha. So Chaim Moser says, I'm not quoting you a chumra of the Chayyadah. There's no Mishkebura then. This is in the Chumash. The Chumash says, if the woman has children, I'm allowed to marry her. He says, I don't listen to any rabbi who comes along. He says, I have to hear it from an authoritative source. So the Chaim Roger says, well, how do I convince you? He says, I have to hear it from Grzinski of Vilna. So the Chaim Roger says, ah, now I know why Hashem put me here, all by myself the week before Rosh Hashanah. So you see, I got a story of Chesed that he was able to dissuade, muscle this person from Gilei Arayos Mamish. By being in the right place in the right time. So it's actually a Maisha Shaya with your Chaim Moser.
What's the status of wind up alarm clocks on Shabbos?
So you're talking about a manual, in other words, not electrical, not digital, not electrical. So you really are not allowed to set them on Shabbos because you're causing them to sound on Shabbos. You can set them before Shabbos, and you're allowed to shut them off on Shabbos. Because the issue to Rabbanon is mashmiyako, to cause noise on Shabbos, but not to be mapsik ko. Now, some people are machmir because they do say that you see in the Gemara that there are certain issues of marisayin, that even to set a noise-producing device before Shabbos may have a makom to be usher. But if you need the alarm clock with Tzorech Mitzvah, we are makel on setting it up before Shabbos. But you should not wind it on Shabbos. If it's digital or electric, then for sure you're not allowed to do anything with it on Shabbos. Yeah.
Does that have a problem with belonging to Mitzvah Hashkafah?
Are you talking about where you live, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, everything is a problem. There's a problem with that, and there's a problem the other way.
Yeah.
In other words, yeah, there certainly is a problem. Now, whether that means you shouldn't do it is a very individual decision. The issue is this. The Rambam says in Hilchos Deos, and the truth is we know this without the Rambam, that a person is very much influenced by his environment, by his surroundings. That's true for you. That would be true for your wife. That would be true for your children, etc. So when you live in a community where people are not so conscientious in Torah and in mitzvahs, that can rub off. Now, yes, you can be a good influence on them. They can be a bad influence on you, right? Which way is it going to go? You never know, right? Maybe it'll be both, but you never know what's the net benefit here. Perkei Avos says, Al tamin bi'atzmecha ad yom mosecha. Do not believe in yourself till the day of death, right? You never know what's going to go on here. So there are costs, you know. On the other hand, there are also benefits. The potential of kirov, the potential of influencing people. Perhaps you can inculcate within your children a greater avas Yisrael, a love of other Jews, which sometimes in insular communities you don't have. So it is an interesting question. I mean, I know people who have deliberately decided, religious people, to live in Eretz Yisrael mixed neighborhoods because they want their children to see other types of Jews and be able to interact with them and influence them. Most Haredim, let's say, make a decision the other way, that they want to create much more insular communities. So it's hard for me to be miyayetz a person, what is the best derech, other than to note that it is an important question in which there are milas and chesronos in both ways, and one has to make a cheshbon, you know, what is best for their family, and what is best for their hashpa. The one thing I will tell you is a teaching that is said in the name of the Chassam Sefer. The Chassam Sefer is a very important teaching that if a person puts himself in a kirub rechaikim situation, where I'm here to bring Jews to Hashem, and he's machabim l'shem shemayim, Hashem promises him his children are not going to be adversely affected. So if you're moving into a mixed neighborhood because you really actively want to be Isaac in Shabbos hospitality and kirov rechaikim, and if your kavana is really l'shem shemayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to protect your children. But if you're just doing it because you like a more relaxed atmosphere, you know, that's a different type of cheshbon. You may not have that. You know, you're going at your own risk. Maybe it'll be okay, maybe not. So you got to be careful about those things. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's called kirov krovim. It's even a phrase. You're makarov of those who already. And Rebbe Weinbach, that's how our Rosh Hashiva used to say. Although I'm not sure how. Well, he said that kirov krovim is even a bigger job than kirov rechaikim. In many ways, it's true, because kirov krovim, people think they're already there, right? Which is wrong. They're already, you know, tzaddikim and the like. So we live under an illusion there. I would say that Klal Yisrael needs both. You know, it goes back to a lot of those questions about, you know, what's more important, the heart or the brain, right? And, you know, the answer is, you know, you die without either one. Klal Yisrael needs all of us to develop our potentials to the greatest level possible. Now, where does a person go to? In other words, where do I put my efforts? Where do I gravitate? You know, what do I do? Do I try to bring every Jew to a basic level of observance? Right? In other words, I'll try to deal with 1,000 Jews to bring them to basic level. Or do I concentrate on 20 or 10 people and keep on making them higher and higher and higher levels? I think that each person has to be makir where their talents are, what they're more attracted to, what they're better at doing. I mean, for example, take a great Rosh Hashiva. A great Rosh Hashiva. Now, you can say, well, why is this great Rosh Hashiva giving some real advanced, complicated shiur to 20 people? Let them go out and put tefillin on people, you know, etc. Yeah, the answer is, many people could do that, and only a few people could do what he's doing, right? Et cetera. So there is room in making all of these decisions to look at your abilities, look at your kochos, look at your talents, and look at where your neshama is attracted. Meaning, you can't. It's a big mistake when people objectively identify something as a priority and then says, everybody got to do that. Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has many, many, many needs in the world. And each person may have a different need that they're filling. Right? So as a result, I think you need people to do both. And of course, let me remind you that sometimes the Rosh Yeshiva, like the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was not Isaac in large-scale cure for Chokin. The Vilna Gaon dealt with a small number of Talmidim that he built up into great, great Gedolim. But those great Gedolim, in turn, were the founders of all of the yeshivas of Europe that continue to grow even today. So the Vilna Gaon, in a sense, has hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Talmidim, even though he may have directly interacted with maybe 100 people, in his lifetime.
Why does Christ not allow Aryan more than one wife?
Well, Doraisa, of course, he is allowed to marry more than one wife. And again, this is Sfardim versus Ashkenazim. Excuse me, Yechim tonight. Ashkenazim are forbidden to marry more than one wife based on a takana of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe, so it's two generations before Rashi. And Rabbeinu Gershom enacted a prohibition of polygamy among Ashkenazic Jews. Originally, it was a temporary law that was supposed to expire in the year 5000. But it got renewed. That it did get renewed. Rabbeinu Gershom was considered to be the supreme authority over Jews in Germany, Poland, and Russia. And those are the Ashkenazi communities. The Sfardim did not accept Rabbeinu Gershom's authority, and they continued to practice polygamy. However, let me point out that Sfardim incorporate today, and really for hundreds of years, what you might call a private chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. I think I mentioned it, that when in a Sfardic chasna, if you've ever been to one, you may notice that the ketubah is much longer than the Ashkenazi ketubah. There's a lot of extra stuff there. And one of the extra stuff is that the chasam takes an oath, a shavua, that he will not marry another wife. And if he marries another wife, he's going to pay $1 million ketubah, or $1 million shekel ketubah, to this woman. So in a sense, you might call this a privatization of Rabbeinu Gershom, meaning they don't have, Ashkenazim don't have to have that because we can't do it anyway. But Sfardim are allowed to do it, and therefore they put it into the Ksuva as a Shavua Chamura, a very solemn oath, not to take another wife. Now, why did Rabbeinu Gershom make that takana? That's a very, very interesting question. It's been pointed out that Rabbeinu Gershom lived in Christian countries where polygamy was forbidden. Goyim didn't do polygamy. Sfardim lived in Islamic countries where polygamy was a common practice, but that's very difficult. Right? In other words, we're just following what the Goyim do. In other words, if the Goyim don't do it, we don't do it. If the Goyim do it, we do it. So the Pashto says Rabbeinu Gershom saw that as the Doros were getting worse and spiritually lower, polygamy was now inconsistent with Shalom Bayis, meaning to say, theoretically, there could be a structure where a person has multiple wives and he loves them and he honors them and they work in cooperation. But as people got less sanctified, less holy, unfortunately, it tended to be a rivalry and a jealousy. And therefore, because of the potential for machlokas and bitterness, he felt it was no longer a proper Jewish practice. And this was the takana of polygamy. Now, certainly, the Torah says, even if you have many wives, you have to love all of them, you have to care about all of them. When that became less of a possibility, so polygamy had to be banned. Yeah.
I thought the takana was over
6 months ago.
6 months ago?
I heard like it was over. Wow. That's big news. No, no, I, okay, I, Okay. I, if you could check that, I'd be very interested. I mean, you know, not for personal reasons, but I don't know. the thing is, what the Shulchan Aruch says is that it was supposed to expire by the sixth millennium, which is the year 5000, and it got renewed. I'm not aware. Now some say the renewal is in the nature of a minhag. That is true. But the notion of 6 months, I'm not sure, it sounds to me maybe you're...
6 months ago, it was a day where it began.
So you're saying the expiration... Okay, I'll check that. Now, you're claiming that even when it was renewed, the expiration of the renewal already happened. I'm going to check that. That's hard to believe, but, you know, I'll check it. Yeah.
I've heard that when the Roman guy put the original consent in Pharaoh's, that one of the reasons was because they did like acrobatics and show. It wasn't like a theological problem yet. Is that true? Was it a theological thing, or was it a...
There were many, many reasons, and there were actually several cherems, some of which the Vilna Gaon signed, some of which he didn't sign. But there were many, many different reasons, and Hasidim had different groups even then, although they didn't have all the different rebbes that they had now. The early Hasidim were called Karliners, by the way, because the first Hasidic groups came from Karlin, although they're not the same as the Karliners today. And some of it involved the idea of changing Nusach, which the Vilna Gaon took very seriously, just changing to Nusach Ari. Some of it involved the fact that they had different practices for Shechita. Some of it involved the emphasis on Torah learning, which the Vilna Gaon obviously took very, very seriously. And some of it involved what you might call more bizarre things. They would do somersaults, they would do acrobats. There was some idea about a certain segment of Hasidim that serving Hashem with all of your body, right? It says, all of my bones, praise Hashem, meant you jump and you do this and that. So there were such things as that. And that was mentioned in some of the communications. Some of them involved very arcane, theoretical, Kabbalistic disputes, which most of us, you know, don't even understand, but they were very big issues, such as what is the nature of Tzimtzum? Tzimtzum is the notion that in order for the world to exist, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to contract his divine presence to make room for the physical world. Chabad, or whatever, Hasid, it's not just what, the Baal HaTanya's definition of Tzimtzum is it's really just an illusion because God is everywhere. Now, the Vilna Gaon felt to say that God is everywhere and God is everything turns the table into God, turns me into God. And the Vilna Gaon felt that definition of Tzimtzum was Avodah Zarah, pantheism, and the Hasidim, you know, different with that. So it ranges, you might call, from the sublime to the ridiculous. In other words, it ranges from the most theological, esoteric debates to kind of the most, you know, rough and ready, you know, somersaults and dancing on tables and everything else. So it runs the whole gamut. Yeah.
So this whole concept, with the level of our generation on right now, is there anything that we actually need that is the change from mind?
Well, we basically assume that nothing is the Shem Shemayim. I mean, that's very, very true. Now, as we understand, we are in a very, very low madrega. We do the best that we can. We try to do what we can. But we never assume that our motives are pure. That's really unfortunate. But that doesn't mean it's an excuse not to serve Hashem. In other words, what does Pirkei Avos say? Pirkei Avos says, Lo alecha amlacha likmor, that even though you're not going to finish the job in a perfect way, you're not a ben chayrin, you're not a free person to say, well, I can't do it 100%, so I'm not going to bother. So we do the best we can, knowing that it's an incomplete job. Okay, be well, thank you, and good.